Everybody, and welcome to another episode of Adventures in DevOps. This week on our panel, we have Jeffrey Groman.
Hey, Jack, how are you doing today?
Doing all right. We also have Caleb Fornari. I'm always worried I'm going to say your name wrong, man.
Yeah, sorry. It's a little long, but you got it right. So good job.
It's all good. So yeah, you're our newest panelist. Do you want to just remind people who you are? It's been a little bit since we had you on.
Sure. Yeah. So my name is Caleb Fornari. I'm the CTO and founder of the Startups Group. We do DevOps as a service and kind of flexible DevOps for small and medium-sized companies.
Awesome. When I went freelance, I was still only a few years into my development career. My first contract, I was paid $60 an hour. Due to feedback from my friends, I raised it to $120 an hour on the next contract. And due to the podcasts I was involved in and the screencasts I had made in the past, I started getting calls from people I'd never even heard of who wanted me to do development work for them because I had done that kind of work or talked about or demonstrated that kind of work in the videos and podcasts that I was making. Within a year, I was able to more than double my freelancing rates, and I had more work than I could handle. If you're thinking about freelancing or have a profitable but not busy or fulfilling freelance practice, let me show you how to do it in my Dev Heroes Accelerator. Dev Heroes aren't just people who devs admire. They're also people who deliver for clients who know, like, and trust them. Let me help you double your income and fill your slowdowns. You can learn more at devheroesaccelerator.com.
All right. Well, we were talking before the show about sort of package security. I'm trying to think of the right terms here for this because, yeah, you were reading a little about this, Jeffrey. And why don't you go ahead and give us the intro since you brought this up and then we can kind of dive in.
Cool. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think it's a topic that can take us in so many different directions because, you know, my mindset is always more security focused, but I also realize that there's so much more to this story that can really just sort of go in different directions. So without, I guess, further ado, it's just, so there was a great, a really interesting story in medium.com by Alex Burson. And he talks about, it's sort of an interesting story by itself in that, you know, he's one of these bug bounty type folks that are out there. A lot of, security researchers make their living off of bug bounties, right? So, just a quick intro to that world. You got big tech companies like PayPal and Apple and Google and others that will pay you specific amounts of money depending on what bugs you find, you know, in their applications, their code, their products, et cetera. For them, it's a great way to stay on top of, you know, what might be lurking out there and really sort of builds that bond with those security researchers. So he started to do some, you know, I guess some research, some sort of playing around and looking at, you know, I think it was like three different languages, whether it was Ruby, Python, or Node. And he was looking at the package managers that are associated with each one. So you've got Pip, you've got RubyGems, you've got NPM. And he's looking at, hey, you know, here's this sort of interesting phenomenon where you could have your own internal code base inside a company that on the one hand may have its own packages that you build or your own libraries that you host internally, but some of them you're also probably pulling down from open source repositories. And what he found was that sometimes you get this sort of information leakage type of a situation where, you know, you can look at code and or you can look at snippets or you can get hit other various ways of sort of finding this. But what he saw was that there were these references to packages that didn't necessarily exist within the public repositories. And so what he found was, well, what happens if I create a public repository, you know, or a public package within a repository that has that same naming convention that this, you mm-hmm. know, company X uses? You know, would their code base look to the public repository first, try to pull it down, incorporate it into their code, and then away you go because you've now got your malicious code, possibly malicious code, running in some company's environment. Now, for the purposes of this article, he doesn't actually write any malicious code, just to be clear there. What he's basically doing is writing something akin to like Hello World, or, you know, I think what he did was I think he actually had it do like a DNS query back to a DNS server that he owned. So a domain and DNS server he owned. So it was really sort of not going to be blocked and he could really get a pretty good handle on, hey, is is this company, is their internal software actually pulling down, you know, these packages and running his code in a very non-malicious, right, very innocuous way. And he could actually go back to them and say, hey, listen, I got this DNS ping. I can see that, you know, code off of your machines, and here's the IP address that it ran from, you know, and timestamp or whatever else, whatever. You know, he pulled like three or four different pieces of metadata around that system. So nothing sensitive, but, you know, enough to sort of prove the point. And he made, you know, something like $100,000 off of, you know, a couple of these things that he found. And it just sort of, you know, I think blows up the story of, wow, that's really interesting on the one hand and a little bit scary on the other hand. But again, I was looking at it from the security standpoint, but I thought you guys would have an interesting take when you think about it, maybe from also like code hygiene and sort of other facets that aren't necessarily security, you know, security focused.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. Go ahead, Caleb.
I know from the like the Node world, you know, there are some solutions, right, to these types of things. And it's not only the issue that you described, Jeffrey, around like what that sounds like essentially is a precedence bug where code is reaching out publicly and pulling packages first. And then if it doesn't find them publicly, it's getting the private packages. But if you just name a public package the same name, then it's going to pull that down, right? Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of other possibilities, right? There's possibilities for malicious code to be inserted in a package, either getting by the maintainers of like an open source project or somebody who takes over the project. You know, a few years ago, they found at least with like NPM, somebody could delete a package. Anyone else could come in and create a new package with the same name, put whatever they wanted in that package. So there's, you know, a bunch of different sort of entry points there. And it is really interesting to talk about this from a security versus developers versus like DevOps perspective, I think, because that's always kind of at odds with, you know, or those groups are always kind of at odds with each other when it comes to like convenience for developers versus security versus, you know, DevOps, maybe concerns around automating things and making things quick and stable and those types of things. So really, really interesting perspective. I think, you know, definitely some interesting stuff to unpack there. From a security perspective, you know, do you have any sort of mitigations that you usually use or recommend to mitigate some of these types of attacks?
I think that's an interesting question, right? Because that's also a little bit tough, right? So, you know, you hit on one of the issues, which is like that sort of, you know, codependency or you know, precedence where, you know, sometimes that maybe that's something that you can sort of do as a first step is make sure that, hey, anything that's hosted internally, make sure that, you know, just make sure that your package manager is only looking at internal systems first and that sort of thing. That can be your first line of defense. And I suppose that, you know, from the DevOps perspective, you probably want to be tracking that, right? You want to make sure that you're pulling the package that you think you're pulling. Right? That, again, to me, seems like that's just, you know, proper etiquette or hygiene or whatever you want to call it. but, you know, but beyond that, there are a lot of, you know, unfortunately in the security world, the response typically is, hey, let's build a new company and a new product and let's sell it. And, you know, we're going to just sell more tools and more technologies and all that. And there are a lot of companies that built tools around, you know, sort of this idea of understanding what's lying behind the scenes of the code base that you're using, right? So it's, you know, you can sort of take apart a piece of code and say, hey, this is what your code is actually built on. Were you aware of that? And you know, and Caleb, I think you're hitting on this too, that there's a lot of different, like this is sort of just the tip of the iceberg. But, you know, for example, you know, remember way back when, only a few years ago, where if you were building your applications on Apache Struts, there was like, it was like in 1 year, I want to say it was like 2017, 2016, something like that. There was like 4 or 5 remote code executable vulnerabilities that came out on Struts. And like in a period of like a few months, it was like ridiculous. And so everyone is sort of trying to figure out from a code composition standpoint, like, wait a second, how many of my Java applications are actually built on Struts? I don't even know because this is legacy code. It's been around for a long time. Who knows what, you know, 2 features in the whole code base are using Struts, but it's still in there and we don't really know about it. So, you know, there's this idea of like, you know, just understanding what the code composition is. And I think that's one of the ways that we've seen, you know, again, from the technology or tools or automation standpoint, trying to figure out what libraries you've built your code on. But I don't think there really is a silver bullet. I don't think there's an easy way to sort of say, oh yeah, we can solve this problem just by, you know, flipping the light switch or something like that. I think this is a tough one.
Well, I have something to throw at you too. And that is, if you've ever gone and actually tried to build, say, a React web app, right? Or even a Ruby on Rails app, right? You just do the bundle install or you do your NPM install. And I mean, an NPM is much more egregious, I think, than like RubyGems and Bundler, right? Because you could get a couple hundred packages or gems and not really know what's even in them, right? Because the overarching package, I installed Rails. Well, Rails pulled in all of its dependencies, and all of those dependencies pulled in their dependencies. And so you're talking about hundreds of packages. This is something that people have complained a lot about NPM for a while, and that is that you can wind up with multiple versions of multiple packages that are dependencies for other multiple versions of multiple packages. And you just kind of get this huge mass of code that you're pulling down. And so just looking at what's being installed, I mean, that kind of an audit, especially if you're doing it manually or visually, it would take you forever. And so it's not really even a practical thing to do. And so you have to trust that the packages that you're pulling in or installing have done the checking on their dependencies, and that their dependencies, you know, on and on down the line. And you just never know. One other thing that came to mind, though, is that in both NPM and RubyGems, so those are the two that I'm most familiar with. I'm not as familiar with some of the other package managers. But the way that I've always managed private code is just by putting in a private GitHub repository and then doing a GitHub reference. And so then it's explicitly requiring from the GitHub repo, but then you're relying on GitHub's security, right? And I remember a few years ago, somebody went in and actually hacked GitHub to give themselves a commit bit on the Ruby on Rails repository, like the core repository that thousands and thousands of people were using to build their apps, right? And so even that's not a silver bullet. The other thing that, two other things that came to mind, just, you know, off of what Kayla pointed out. One was, you know, what if the package gets taken down and another one gets put up? Well, when it gets taken down, if you try and install it from NPM or RubyGems, they'll complain, right? I can't find this package. Barf, barf, barf. You know, not happy. But yeah, if somebody were to replace it, then that would be a different story. And that reminds me of the LeftPad package in NPM actually got removed. I can't remember exactly what. I think there was some internet drama. The package manager said, I'm out, I'm done, you all can't use my code anymore, and took LeftPad off the internet. The problem was is that everybody and their mother was dependent on LeftPad. And so everybody's installs failed, and NPM actually went and put the package back so that these packages wouldn't fail. The other one that comes to mind is in 2018, there was a hack where a maintainer of a package called EventStream, and I'll put a link to the episode where we talked about it on JavaScript Jabber, but there's also another breakdown by SNCC where essentially it wasn't being actively maintained. Somebody came along and said, hey, can I help you maintain it? And then they inserted malicious code. So anyway, you know, this happens a lot of different ways. And so, yeah, it's harder than you think if you're just thinking, oh, yeah, let's just check this stuff. And I know that other people are thinking this too, that there's a lot going on that you just can't always know about.
Yeah, it's one of those problems that is never solved. You can only try to minimize your attack surface, right? So a couple practical things that are probably worth mentioning when you're using package managers. Obviously, the first one is just try to minimize the packages you're using, right? Mm-hmm. Try to pull in less third-party code. If you're using just a small piece of a giant library or something, just grab that piece and try to incorporate it into your code if it's open source or whatever, rather than pulling the whole library in. I think some of the package managers allow you to pull in parts of a package as well. So there's some support for that depending on the package manager you're using. The other thing is you can pin to known versions. So a lot of developers by default will just say pull the latest version of this package. but you can actually pull, depending on, again, the package manager, they have varying levels of support for this, but you can also pin to a specific version or say this version with, you know, any security patch or latest security patch, right? So you're getting like security patches back to that version, but you're not pulling like the latest version of the library you're using. So at least when you actually need to upgrade it, you're aware of it and you can at least look at that. Okay, there's not been any suspicious, you know, activity around this library or, you know, things like that. So there are practical sort of things you can do to help minimize this problem. But really, like you said, Chuck, it never goes away. It's not something you can solve, right? You can't audit all the code that's being pulled in. There's recursive dependencies going down the line. Packages are pulling in packages and things like that, which brings me to kind of maybe the larger topic at play here, which is if, let's say, malicious code does end up in your repository or, you know, built into one of your applications, how do you then minimize the fallout from that, right? I think that's probably the more interesting question from a security perspective. And maybe that's something Jeffrey has some insight on.
Yeah, fortunately, we're seeing that, you know, played out. I think, you know, a couple of episodes ago, Chuck and I were talking about the SolarWinds breach. And that's really what...
Yes.
Yeah, right. I mean, that was a perfect segue back into that. But I think that was such an amazing discovery. So it was discovered, I think, by CrowdStrike, who was working on behalf of SolarWinds. But what they found was that, just to give you an example of something that, like, real life example, right? What they found was that the malicious code for SolarWinds wasn't actually going into the repository. It was part of the build process. So what they had done was the threat actor, the bad guys, had compromised the build server and had injected a separate piece of malware into the build server that was basically just running, you know, is persistent on the system. So it's just running the background. I think it was running as like a Windows service. And it was just looking for like the msbuild.exe process. I think that's what it was, right? So the build process, every time it saw it, it would try to inject, you know, a piece into the .NET assembly. And there was a lot of good checks on it and all that. Like, what happens if for whatever reason it failed? It would pull it back out so that the build would still be clean so that it wouldn't attract attention. Because clearly, if you had a build that has errors or, you know, other problems afterwards, that would be a clear red flag that, hey, something happened and, you know, they're going to investigate it. So it was a pretty sophisticated piece of malware that, you know, that was running that to sort of make sure that, on the one hand, try to get their code into each consecutive build, and then that new version, that update of SolarWinds goes up on the website and people start downloading it and they have a malicious, you know, backdoor built into it. But on the other hand, really a lot of checks to make sure that it's building cleanly and there's no problems with it. So, you know, you look at a scenario like that and you say, okay, how do I protect myself against that? That actually, in a lot of ways, is sort of the classic case of how do I find when somebody is malicious is in my environment, and there's ways that we look at to doing that. Some of it's technology and tools to be able to look for malware and that sort of thing. Something as custom as this, however, you might be looking for, you know, anything that's sort of out of the ordinary. And you know, if you think about a build server, especially if you're SolarWinds, you would want to be putting your security folks onto the build server, right? They should be very focused on what's going on with the build server. Let's monitor it. Let's make sure that there isn't something nefarious or something just bizarre going on that doesn't seem quite right. So I think some of it is, if you're a company that builds a lot of software and that's your bread and butter, then you need to really take security seriously in that you're really doing a lot of monitoring and you're looking for very specific types of things. Like, you know, this isn't, you know, like in the case of SolarWinds, it's not like it was some piece of ransomware or commonly found malware that ended up on this build server. It was a very custom piece of malware that was on there. So you're not going to find it just by running antivirus or something. You know, you can't just like sort of run something out of the box and say, well, that should find, you know, any types of issues that I would have from a security standpoint. So I think part of it is really just understanding who you are as a company. And if you're building a lot of software and you know that this is, you know, possibly a risk you might be facing, it's the investment of, okay, we've got to really focus on keeping an eye on our software repository, for instance, because they may go after that. We've seen that in the past where threat actors have been able to get into a software repository and put malicious code right into the repository, and then it just gets built in. Or like in the example of SolarWinds, looking at your build server. So I mean, those would be two areas that you'd want to be looking at, and looking at it from a from the perspective of what's going on that's out of the ordinary. And I mean, we could spend a lot of time. I don't really want to, you know, dig into this too deeply. In other words, how do you do that? There's a lot that gets into a lot of tradecraft in the security world. How do we do that? How do we look for threats? How do we identify them? How do we find them early enough so that this sort of story of SolarWinds doesn't happen to your company? There's a lot to that, and that would be, you know, several episodes on its own. But just to mark this off, what we're talking about is a focus, it's an emphasis, it's an investment into people, process, and technology. That's what security comes down to. It's all three of those components. And it means that you've got to be focused on all three of those if you really want to have a capable security program that's going to protect you from these types of risks.
Something in the DevOps world that we talk about a lot is kind of the shift left mentality as well, where you have all those pieces you just talked about working together from the beginning of a project, right? So you're really thinking about the security and, you know, operating and developing any given application from the beginning, rather than thinking of those as separate departments that sort of don't really talk to each other. You know, part of the DevOps philosophy is get everyone talking to each other early and often, make sure there's none of those knowledge silos. And then that really allows you to catch some of those issues early, prevent some of them later on, and, you know, end up just with a better sort of more homogenous system all around, I think.
Hey folks, if you love this podcast and would like to support the show, or if you wish you could listen without the sponsorship messages, then you're in luck. We're setting up new premium podcast feeds where you can get all of the episodes released after Christmas 2020 without the ads. Signing up will help us pay for editing and production, and you can go sign up at devchat.tv/premium.
Yeah, I think that's crucial. It's too often I see the same thing where the security team is just off in a silo. And mm-hmm. And even more unfortunate is where the security team is so much in a silo that they're not even all that keenly aware of the business. Like, how does the business make money? What should I, you know, where should I focus my security resources? And so I think breaking down those silos is so crucial, and getting everybody together and getting everybody like working together and saying, how do we solve, like, here are the risks that we think, you know, our business faces, you know, and if we're in the business of building software, that's got to be one of them. How do we inject, you know, security into that process at an early stage? How do we all work together and not just, you know, end up in that finger pointing or other type of, you know, sort of blame game or something like that?
Yeah. If your security is out of touch with kind of the business in general, or the developers or the operations people or whoever it is, they can't really make effective decisions around where to prioritize resources and what to put emphasis on and whether something is worth, you know, the potential security trade-offs and all those kind of things. You mentioned the build server earlier and getting your security people into that one. I think that's a really good example where quite often that's seen as like a DevOps or a developer thing, and you don't have security people looking at that or even maybe aware of what's running there, what it's doing, those kind of things. And it's difficult to really build that culture where security people are seen as, you know, a welcome partner in that process rather than like someone that's just saying no to things, right? So right. It's really important to approach that carefully, but it can be done. I've seen, you know, great cultures and companies where security is very involved and they're seen by developers as an ally, not as a, you know, potential adversary. So that's super important, kind of approaching that in the right way and, you know, making sure that you have the culture to kind of support that as well.
Yeah. I totally agree. I think part of it is also just, you know, how you work together and how you, you know, how you complement each other, right? Because each person is coming to it with their own skill set and their own experience. And I think, you know, what's necessary is everybody needs to be able to learn from each other. And I think what happens too often in those siloed environments is that you get, for whatever reason, you get those sort of shields are up and no one wants to sort of learn from each other and work together on it, a common set of, you know, priorities. And, you know, the more that you can get everybody sort of just talking to each other and learning from each other, right? Discussing this, hey, how do we solve this? This is all of our problem. How do we solve this problem and, you know, minimize the risk or whatever it is? Because I agree that there's, you know, there are many good examples of companies who are doing this really, really well. Unfortunately, not enough of them. I think there's too many companies that aren't doing it all that well. But I
want to jump in here because what we've been talking about is kind of managing this situation where we have something in our dependency tree that's been compromised one way or the other. And so I'm just imagining something that's like 4 or 5 levels deep that is deeply embedded in what we do that is going to be non-trivial to pull out, right? And so I'm just imagining, okay, that's 3 weeks worth of work. And, the CEO sitting there going, well, that means that it'll take us 1 week longer than we can stay in business. So what do you do, right? How do you balance that out? Because you do have a responsibility to the people whose information you have, right? You do have a responsibility to the people who are involved in the product and process. But at the same time, I mean, anybody who's a stakeholder in that business, right? Anyway, I'm just curious what approach you would take to that.
So my quick, retort to that, and I agree with you, is that the biggest risk to any business is cash flow. And everyone's got to take that. The security team needs to take that in mind as well. If, securing the company means that you're going to kill revenue for a certain amount of time and the business goes under because of it, that's the biggest risk. Everything else you can live with. Any other risk you can live with. But cash flow is the one you cannot live with. You can't live with risking your cash flow. So, and I think that's what I think what Caleb and I were talking about too, is that everyone's got to be on the same page, that is the biggest risk. Right. I think all too often, you may have the developers or the DevOps team who are going off saying, I don't care what the business does. This is what we're doing. Like we're writing code and we're getting builds out the door. And the security team might be saying, we don't care about anything else. Our job is to try and minimize all the cyber risks. And all those teams need to get together and say, no, here's our biggest risk and here's how we keep revenue coming. And outside of that, we can talk, right? Everything else is on the table to talk about how we figure out how to minimize all the other risks. But we have to keep customers going. We got to keep the revenue flowing and we got to keep the cash flow. That's table stakes for keeping the business going. And I think all too often that conversation isn't happening.
Yeah. One way you can help with this, and it's not appropriate for all companies, but the way I've seen this work in some companies is they actually make teams cross-functional. So you don't really have a security team and a development team and an operations team. You have, some developers and an ops or DevOps guy and a security person on the same team, and they're all responsible for the same product, right? It's very difficult to take a team of security people and inject them into a bunch of different departments in the company and have them telling people what to do. But if they're part of a team that's responsible for a product, then they understand, kind of the business side of the business necessities and the need to actually ship product. And, you can never have perfect security. So there's always going to be concerns and things you can optimize and all those kind of things. But they get a much better sense of that balance. And conversely, developers and DevOps people get a much better sense of security concerns. And they're going to be thinking about them a lot more if they're talking to someone every day who's dealing with those things and thinking about those things. So if it's possible to kind of deconstruct your teams a little bit and get cross-functional teams going that have that security element in them, I think that's very effective as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. I've said this a few times, that I think the future of security teams is that they're going to shrink, not grow. And I think that's why. Because it's not that, I'm not saying they'll shrink, meaning that you'll have fewer resources. It means that they won't be part of a security team. They'll be part of all the other teams. Like they'll be embedded in technology teams across, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's code, whether it's whatever it is, all the different pieces of technology, they need to be embedded in there. I totally agree with that.
Like ironically, spies.
Ironically, I think that will actually make the need for security grow rather than shrink, right? I think you'll see more demand for security people as that transition happens, because they're no longer just siloed and seen as some kind of a business expense. Kind of the way that DevOps or ops people, system administrators, were seen as like these guys in a closet hunched over a server doing like things and we're just a business expense. And then in the cloud age, it's kind of become this integral part of shipping software. I think security is going to be the same way. We see more and more breaches, and we've seen the SolarWinds thing, and I'm thinking of the don't think it was Expedia, but it was another credit agency that got
breached. Experian?
Equifax.
Experian, yes.
Equifax. It was Equifax. That's right.
Yeah.
I don't want to get in trouble for saying the wrong one.
Okay. Equifax. Right. Let's be clear on that. Don't want to slander anyone else. But I think that's an example of something where the cost of a breach was really, really high and really public. Yeah. And we're going to see more of those in the coming, years as more and more user data is stored online. I think COVID has accelerated that trend. We have more data than ever online and things being built faster than ever. More people coming online, more parts of people's lives are online that are really critical to them. So as that happens, we're going to see definitely an increased need for security and a need for practical security where they're more integrated into the daily workflows rather than being siloed off somewhere in their own team.
Yeah. Well, the thing that was really interesting about the Equifax breach, and we're seeing this even more now, like you said, due to COVID, but also just due to the way that the world is going and working these days, is that we're having larger and larger repositories of personal data where people are going. So, the Disney Pluses, the Netflix, the Twitters, the Facebooks, where almost everybody has an account on that, right? And so it's not just that we're putting more information online, but we're also gathering it in a lot of these large data silos that, when they get breached, they affect a lot more people.
Yeah.
So one other thing that I'm kind of envisioning here is, let's say, going back to my question before, if I find that there's a dependency that's 4 or 5 levels deep in my code, I mean, what process do I have to actually figure that out and take it out? I mean, do I have to just kind of go in and rewrite dependencies or, offer to help maintain the dependency that's the problem? Or, I'm kind of trying to figure out where I go from there, assuming that the project isn't maintained and that, or not the project, but the open source project, the repo isn't maintained. And there's going to need to be some approach to that. And I'm assuming other people are going to be solving it too, but usually you're on a time frame where you can't necessarily wait for other people to figure it out.
Yeah. One thing I would throw out there is, having been part of that process, way back when I used to work for Veracode, right? So if you're not familiar, code security company, and we used to look at these open source packages and sometimes run static code scans against it and that sort of thing. And, what we found was that the packages that were really actively being developed, right? So that you could go to that team and say, hey, we found some issues with the code, maybe potential issues or what have you, right? We're not talking about something got compromised or whatever, but looking at it from a code quality standpoint, from the security standpoint, right? So the packages that are really actively being maintained, those types of issues could get prioritized pretty quickly and fixed. And I mean, I think if I were, sort of in a position of leadership in a software company, I would feel much more confident about bringing in a package, into my assembly that is really actively being maintained, is very responsive when we bring up, either bug issues or feature requests or that sort of thing. And I think I'd be very reticent if I saw that we are going to bring in a dependency that is not being all that actively maintained, is not all that responsive, and doesn't have a huge community behind it, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, I realize that's sort of, not really definitive, but I think that maybe it points to a certain direction anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's super important. It's one of those sort of social proof metrics that's really hard to define. Right. There's no set metric for what is a trustworthy project and what is not. Right. It's kind of going to depend on, the technology you're using and all those kind of things. But you can look at GitHub. That's the beauty of the open source world. You can see it there. You can see who's working on it, what's going on, how active it is. And like you said, if there is a security issue in a very active project, they in some cases will actually get disclosure before it's publicly disclosed, mm-hmm. and they'll actually patch it before it comes out to the public. So that's a really, useful thing with widely used packages as well. And that's true of operating systems like Linux and things like that. Also, there's a pretty good process in place for disclosing things and patching them before the vulnerability gets disclosed. I do think for smaller projects or more niche projects, it's really difficult to look at that metric, because quite often if you're doing something fairly unique, there might be like a few other people doing a similar thing, and you can probably save yourself a couple months worth of writing code by pulling in this package that maybe only a few other people are maintaining, but you know, for business reasons, it's still worth it, right? So I think that's where we kind of circle back to, how do you manage those dependencies? Are you always pulling the latest version in? Are you pinning to a known good version? And then if there is a security issue that comes up, it's going to depend on whether it was something that was introduced, right? So if it was something that got introduced recently, might not affect you if you're pinned to an older version. If it's something that was there and was just discovered recently, then it's going to affect probably all versions until it's patched. So your approach is going to look different depending on what that vulnerability looks like and probably how many layers deep in your dependencies is it. If it's 4 or 5 layers deep in some package, you know, you don't use that much, you might be able to find an alternative that doesn't have that vulnerability. If it's, you know, a huge package, you might just have to wait for, you know, a mitigation to come out or something like that, and take whatever steps you can in the meantime to minimize the, you know, sort of fallout and monitor for anybody trying to exploit that vulnerability, things like that. There's often things you can do at the network level, for example, to cut down on a lot of vulnerabilities, or, you know, sort of keep out a class of vulnerabilities, or keep data from exfiltrating your network, and those kind of things help as well.
Yeah, it's always interesting too, because you're talking about working on or using code repos that are actively maintained, but even then sometimes it comes with a, here's the update and here's how to know that you, whether or not you were compromised. And so you've got to do that work too.
Yep, absolutely. And knowing kind of what is going on in your network in those cases, I think is super important. So understanding sort of what's happening on a network level, what kind of data is actually being exfiltrated from your networks, whether that's in the cloud or on-premise, becomes very important as well. Often that's kind of the real sign of like, has this been exploited yet? Is data exiting our network and going somewhere that we don't know about or don't expect it to?
Awesome. Well, is there anything else that we should pounce on here before we start wrapping up and do picks?
Nothing else comes to mind for me. I think that's a good high-level overview of that topic.
Yeah, agreed. I think it's, you know, this is going to be one of those that we will probably keep coming back to, because we're going to see, unfortunately, this is just the reality. We're going to see more, you know, software compromises and you know, malicious software being injected into code bases. It's just too effective. It's you know, it's too promising for threat actors. And so we are going to see more of this.
I agree. Yeah.
Hey, folks, I don't know if you've noticed, but I've been working a lot on figuring out how to help people become the most valuable developers on their teams, or becoming the top 5% of developers in the field. If you're looking to level up, figure out how to contribute more, get the career you want, get the career that you want that will support the lifestyle you want, then you should check out the Most Valuable Dev Summit. I've invited some of my friends across the community, people that you've heard of, people that have worked on systems that you use on a daily basis, people who have invented new ways of doing things over the years in programming, and I've asked them one question, and that question is, how do you become a top 5% developer? How do you become 1 in 20 of the best developers out there? And so we're going to go ahead and have that conversation with them in interviews on the Most Valuable Dev Summit. And you can find that at summit.mostvaluable.dev.
All right, let's go ahead and do some picks. Jeff, do you want to start us off with picks?
You know, I wanted to, I was going to do something else, but Caleb just made me think of something. And you know, I feel like I didn't want to, you know, talk about this during the actual, because this is a bit of like a segue off, but I'm going to use it as my pick. And that is something that we call in the IT world, I guess, asset management. And it shocks me. So it's a bit of a pick, but it's more of a, it's just an understanding. And it shocks me how often I go, you know, I get in front of clients and you just ask some simple questions like, you know, what do you know about all the different, let's say, systems in your environment, whether we're talking about, you know, desktops or servers or virtual servers or cloud instances of EC2 or whatever it is. An asset could be any of those digital assets, right? Where your data is. It's just amazing how few companies really have a handle on where, you know, how many assets they have, what are they, where are they really being managed actively, where's all the data? Where's the structured data? Where's the unstructured data? Like, where's it pulled out from using APIs and that sort of thing? Like, where is it sitting in people's spreadsheets or Google Sheets or whatever it is? Like, I don't really quite understand that, but I feel like that's just something like, to me, it's just the basics of like, if you're running a, you know, a technology company or technology organization, you got to know where the stuff is. You can't protect what you don't know, like what you're not actively managing. So that's my pick for this week, is get your arms around all of those assets, figure out what's going on. It's not that hard. It's not that hard to at least get your arms around 80 to 90% of it. You might not get all of it, but you can get your arms around a lot of it without a lot of effort.
Nice. How about you, Caleb?
Yeah, I didn't prepare anything for this week, but I think something that sort of came up in the course of talking about the issue we've just been talking about, it's something I touched on briefly right at the end there, was network level security. And there's a concept in network level security, which is sort of hard outside, soft inside, where you see a lot of companies doing a very good job of securing their external facing networks. So anybody coming from the outside, getting in, you know, it's pretty secure and pretty difficult to like infiltrate their network that way. But what you don't see very often is hard inside security, meaning like if someone does get into your network, what can they reach? What can they access? What can they actually do with that? And so my pick would just be being more sort of aware of that trade-off and understanding where your internal network vulnerabilities lie, how you can mitigate those, and, you know, sort of planning for what actually happens if someone does get into your network and is able to, you know, get onto one of your internal machines. How do you make sure they can't reach all your other internal machines? Make sure you have proper separation internally of data, of servers, of, you know, public-facing web stuff, those kind of things. I think that's really overlooked in the security world a lot, and it's really one of the most effective things you can do if you are breached and someone does get past those internal defenses somehow, either via one of the methods we talked about today or some other method. That's how you mitigate that damage on a, you know, kind of network and internal access level.
Nice. I'm going to throw in a few picks of my own. The first one is the Dev Heroes Accelerator. If you are looking to kind of go beyond the senior developer, senior DevOps engineer, you're trying to figure out what that next stage is. I've had a lot of people ask me about how to increase their influence, increase their reach, help more people, get paid more. And all of that is encapsulated in the Dev Heroes Accelerator. I kind of think of Dev Heroes as beyond senior developer or senior DevOps. So anyway, if you're interested in that, go to devchat.tv/heroes, and that will take you to a place where you can actually, yeah, put in some information so that I can start communicating with you about whether or not you'll be a good fit for that, because I only want to take people that I can really help. And so, yeah, it's just a short application. It'll take you a few minutes to fill it in, and then we can kind of go from there. But yeah, I'm already helping a few people start podcasts and pull together what they need to do that. Another pick that I have is I started watching The Umbrella Academy on Netflix, and it's kind of a weird show, but I really kind of like it. So yeah, quirky stuff, but yeah, I've been enjoying it. Just finished season one. So I'm going to shout out about that too. And then finally, the last thing that I'm going to pick is, so this week, especially Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, today's Wednesday, but you know, this morning, what I did is I just took some time off. I actually checked into a hotel room because I had to still carpool my kids home from school. So I take off in the middle of the day and drive them home and then go back to the hotel and just got some downtime. I was super burned out and, you know, I'm feeling a lot better about things now. And so I'm just going to pick that to, you know, just if you need some mental space, if you need to just kind of relax and unwind to get some quiet, then I can't recommend that highly enough. I just went on Expedia and found a deal. I also found a deal on VRBO, incidentally, but they never got back to me before I had to like book a hotel room. So anyway, yeah, yeah. Just find some place and get away.
I heard something similar that there's hotel chains that just, you know, during this whole COVID, you know, period, that they're sort of marketing towards that sort of thing of like, you know, parents who are just trying to get away and need a quiet place to work. as opposed to people need to actually sleep at a hotel, like a place to go during the day and just work and then, you know, leave in the evening or whatever. So yeah, I understand there probably are deals at that hotels that are empty and, you know, it's a win-win.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks guys. I'm going to go ahead and wrap us up, and until next time, max out everybody.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.